Yes. Hello, everyone. This is Jim Collins. Next episode of Excelsior Capital Partners, the Rising Series. So with us are Scott Wallace and Raymond Cole from ECD Automotive. And I don't want to take up too much of their time so we can get to the nitty-gritty and the cool stuff and the product. But hopefully, I think maybe Scott can give us a sort of brief history of ECD Automotive and you know, how you got to where you are today.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having us. I appreciate the time. I mean, I'm going to be frank. It was not our intention to be here today.
That's okay.
That's not what ECD was about. We had a beer one night, four Brits at my house. I was private equity background and public sectors in Europe. I decided to come to the US with my children and wife to kind of slow down a little. I met the Humbles at a barbecue at my house. We drank some beer, convinced ourselves there was an opportunity to take a British farm vehicle and turn it into a luxury product for an American audience. The more beer we drank, the more we convinced ourselves it was a great idea. I called Tom out and said, you're not going to do anything. You've got a secure job with VW and Porsche and the sales training side. Elliot was at college. Lo and behold, I woke up to a text the following morning saying Tom had resigned from his job and Elliot wasn't going back to college. Was the idea. That's how it began. But we didn't wake up the following morning and say, let's get on the NASDAQ. We woke up the following morning and I was terrified because I was with two young guys. I'd come from private equity and I thought, how do I educate these guys on how to scale a business without consuming them in kind of private equity, corporate mindset, strategies and behaviors? Yes. Because they just weren't, they didn't have a resume to do that. So we went to a gas station. I said, just tell me a few things you want to do with the business. And ultimately what we said we wanted to do was disrupt the automotive sector. Nobody really likes buying a car. I don't think anybody would ever tick a box and say they love servicing a car or warranting it. And we just discussed why is that. And with my background in private equity, predominantly we were in luxury, high-end hospitality, country clubs, health clubs, hotel chains. And I said, I think it's missing the human aspect of it. I think it's missing relationship management. So that was it. So the anchors of the business were put the consumer at the center of the experience, put mechanics at the center of the experience, so they're building cool stuff, not fixing it. And let's have a retention strategy, not a recruitment strategy for mechanics. Thirdly, build everything in-house. Don't subcontract anything. Fourth, every single truck is one of one. You can never repeat the truck. We build one of one vehicles. So when other automotive dealers say one of 500 make you feel special, I don't know that makes you feel special when you stood next to 498 other people at a 419 other people at a car show. Never happened with any of our cars. And you own the intellectual property once you design it. It's your vehicle. And then the last thing was that we wanted to always keep building something that excited us. So that was it. So they were the anchors of the business. We set out over the next decade doing exactly that. I put 150,000 liquid into the business, my own cash. Okay. We never borrowed another penny for a decade.
Wow.
We never took any outside capital. We never even took vendor credit terms. We ran it in our own dollar. We deployed capital incredibly effectively. We only ever put it into parts to build cars or hands to build cars. Wow. We never had fancy titles. We never even had business cards. We never had a logo above the building. We never had flowers in the entrance. We never had any cost because we couldn't afford to at the time. The demand for our product was outstripping how quickly we could supply it.
Wow.
So we figured out the sweet spot in classic car restorations about a year. Anything above that and attrition rates are high. So we got into a model of build one, sell one, build two, sell two, build three, sell three. And we just stayed in that for a decade. Remarkably, over that decade, we got to 22 million revenue on our own. So we came from 150,000 liquid to 22 million revenue, all self-funded, bootstrapped by ourselves.
Wow.
We did it. We did exactly what we said we would do, brought everything in-house, paint facility came in-house, upholstery came in-house. We're now a team of 100 employees across two continents. Wow. We have 84 million lifetime revenue. So we're not a typical SPAC. I always find that interesting that SPACs are perceived as an idea that hasn't really done much and it's a test and a guinea pig.
Yes.
We're not that. We are not that. We've done $84 million of revenue in the last decade in our own diamond dollars. We've had a 30% compound annual growth rate for a decade. We've had 19% pricing compound annual growth rate increases for a decade. We've got industry-leading margins. You know, we through commanding a price point for the quality of the product we build, and secondly, the customization elements we own. That's how we drive our margin. And we've got over 500 of our products out there in the streets and driving around, and people living with them daily. So that's kind of the history in a nutshell of what the idea was, how we got to it. And then lo and behold, we met Ben. Ben's on the call today from EFR and Bank. And you know, Ben came, he just contacted us one day. We'd sold a couple of trucks to people in the bank that Ben had worked with. Ben was a bit of a fanboy. He's going to hate me for saying that. Ben was a social fanboy. We've got 500,000 fans across social media as well. So
wow.
Ben was one of those. We make a vested interest in you know, making sure we entertain our fan base. They deserve that. They've been very helpful. Ben was one of those. One day there was a conversation where the guy who bought the truck in the bank was talking to Ben, who was following us, and Ben was running a SPAC at the time, and they were looking for targets, and sponsors were looking for targets, and Ben identified us, and Ben flew down, and I liked that first and foremost because he got on a plane and came to saw us, and he didn't ask the obvious stuff. You know, I was in private equity for many years, and normally they ask about the balance sheet and the P&L. But, yeah, you know, when I was in private equity, I looked for the product, the people, and the demand. And Ben did exactly that, and Ben just worked with us, and then we kind of held each other's hands for about 18 months and walked over the line and de-SPACed. So Ben can probably give you a little bit of flavor on that one, but that's the history of the business and where we got to the going public.
Okay. And in terms of the way the company is structured today, with the facility in Florida in Kissimmee, you know, if we were there, for instance, and we decided not to go to Disney World, and we instead went to your facility, what would we see? I mean, what is it sort of? My background is automotive, huge plants. You know, like Wolfsburg, Toyota City, all those places. I've been to Detroit too many times. So what would we see if we walked into your facility in Florida today?
There's a couple of great questions there. You said one first and foremost is you wouldn't believe how many people go to Disney World and actually then come and visit us.
Oh, nice.
It is a cool tour. You know, every day we have people rock up. I think one day we had seven different nationalities in the building touring from all over the world. So, yeah, a fan base like that. What does the building look like? Great question. I think the biggest advantage for the four Brits who founded this, none of us were from automotive or manufacturing. Now, when you can't afford in the early days, like we couldn't, manufacturing engineers and plant engineers and, you know, mechanical engineers, you got to figure stuff out. So I love taking the noise out of business. So we develop very simple systems based around footprint and movement and flow, and supporting that with feeder bays so you could assemble as much as you could away. So the it's a big box. It's 100,000 square foot inside and outside box, brand new, built in 2022, we moved in. It's a rectangular box. The production line is about 180 foot long by 100 foot wide. That's where the main plant is. Supporting that, we have feeder bays, which we call. So the paint shop, upholstery shop, sub-assembly bays, an electrical wiring harness. They all are in a lovely air conditioning building off the side of it. That creates a big divide. That creates a big divide between mechanics, by the way, the air conditioned part and the not. so these guys are all feeding into the main line. And then what we had to do, which has never been done, and I think if somebody said, what did we manage to do that nobody else has figured out? We took the efficiencies of a volume automotive manufacturing plant that had to move in a line, but we added the fluidness of extreme levels of customization.
Okay.
So the simple rule we have is there are about 20 movements of the car, but each movement is 4 days. It's a 4-day tack time. Mm. So the car will go through those 20 steps, and in 4 days, somebody will, an individual technician or a couple of technicians will do a number of actions in that 4-day period. So whether it be tearing the original car down, the frame repairing the original car, putting the undercarriage and axles on, then it'll move to drivetrain, then it'll move to electrics, then it'll move to sub-assembly in three phases.
Okay.
So we have a system we developed on our phones, on our iPhones, our tablets, our PCs, where we can see every car in production. I can then click into it. I can see how many tasks it takes to build it. I can see how many tasks have been completed, how many are open. I can see it by department. I can see it's been quality checked three times by the technician who did it, his line manager, and the quality control manager as it's been done in real time. That is software we wrote. We designed it ourselves. We took all the noise out. The CPO, who's Emily Humble, one of the original founders, Emily runs all the production.
Okay.
Emily has a CPO dashboard. I have a CEO dashboard. It's real time. If something isn't done correctly in real time, we'll get an alert in our dashboard saying, go and focus on that area. Our QC team is not typical of a QC team in automotive manufacturing. It isn't post-build. We took that labor and we said, if you want to get real QC, do it in real time. Rather than sending data and reports saying something isn't good enough, turn the QC team into a training and coaching team. So as we identify an issue in our dashboards that says something isn't right, we send the QC team in and they retrain in real time that technician. So that's one of the reasons we have 100% retention of mechanics this year.
Wow.
We had 95% retention in 2023 of mechanics. I believe the industry average in the USA is 48%.
Yeah. I'm surprised it's even that high.
So we don't have a recruitment strategy. You will very rarely find a job advertised on any of the classic recruitment sites for ECD because we invest heavily in recruitment of guys, in the training, the culture. The culture is phenomenal. We don't have middle managers.
Okay.
We also have a culture. Nobody's going to believe me when they say it and say it's just corporate waffle and chit-chat, and it isn't. The C-suite in this business are employed to work for the mechanics. We all have to work for them. There is a board in each department. It's called Killing Me. It's a written board. There's lots of other things in the board. It talks about things that they're focusing on in production and QC scores and the next build of the building. But there's one box that says Killing Me. If any mechanic in this building has a reason that's going to affect quality or time, they put Killing Me in the box. They write that problem. Because nothing annoys me more in corporate life when somebody says, well, I dealt with that via an email. Nothing is dealt with via an email. It's just an area to hide behind and say, yeah, you emailed me, but I was lost. But if it goes on the Killing Me board, a member of the C-suite has to identify the problem and help fix it in real time. Because the technician is saying, I can't do my job. So then we will work with, typically it's the warehouse or the procurement team or the buying team, and say, well, why are we not able to source this? What's the problem, and help fix it?
Okay.
It is very much run the entire business like a sports team. So we have an offense, a defense, a locker room, and a back office. But we are collectively all trying to win the Super Bowl.
Yes.
So it's a very simple mindset, and it's a very simple accountability process. And the last thing I need is 25 quarterbacks with egos.
Yep. I think that, and I noticed this in your corporate presentation, which is very good, by the way. I will put a link to that on all my socials. But it mentioned that for each vehicle, there are, I believe the number was, correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the number was 2,200 man hours of labor.
Yep.
So I guess the question is, A, is that correct? And B, when you look at that as the business manager, how do you scale that if you start making, you know, thousands of cars or 8,000 cars a year? I know the current capacity is listed at 196, but just the trying to get to the scalability of this business.
Yeah, I think that's the thing we have to educate. I mean, first and foremost, let's consider the price point. We don't need to build 8,000 cars because of the price point. You know, our average price point per vehicle is $338,000 as we sit here today, and I look at my dashboard.
Okay.
To my left. So that's real time. It's telling us what clients are signing off in upgrades and what the initial contract price is. So it's never going to be a volume business, but that does not mean you cannot scale. And I think that's important. We'll get into that in a second.
Sure, sure.
Back to your question about the 2,200 man hours. 2,200 man hours is a collection of man hours because, taking my sports analogy, that's everybody. It's the purchasing team. It's the design team. It's the client services team. The man hours to build it are about 1,500, what we call offensive team. Offensive team is the guy with the techs. So that's about 1,500 hours. So we're turning a car every 4 days in production. So every 4 days, one is coming off the line. with that average price point of $338,000. The building as it stands today was always designed, the big box I talked about, so we could have three production lines running in, you know, linear lines just running all the time. As we sit here today, one of the lines is at 100% capacity and sold out until quarter one, 2025.
Wow.
The second line only runs at 50% currently and is sold out until the end of 2024. And the third line is where the opportunity sits. So what I'm going to do now is step back and bring in a lot of factors about why we went public and what the organic opportunities and everything else. So the way I see it, there are three opportunities to scale. If you just take the big box I talked about, our sports field, if you want to call it that, where we play, there are three production lines there. And each one is capable of about $25 million revenue. So last year we did $22 million. We've issued guidance this year of $33 million. But by 2026, with all lines at the capacity, that's potentially $75 million.
Okay. Because
three lines. But interestingly, that's on one shift, 5 day a week, 8 hours. So when we talk about those units, somewhere between 180 and 200 units a year, that absolutely, without raising any external capital, is within our reach.
Okay.
It's completely organic. And the testament to that is we got to 83 million lifetime revenue with 150 liquid doing exactly the same process. We just added space, we added hands, we added parts, and we just built more and we built quicker and better. So the first plan of attack for us is organic because it's sitting in the building. The rent stays the same. The OPEX is the same no matter how we build.
Sure.
So our strategy is to get that OPEX line just rapid decline by going from building, I'm sure Ray will jump in, but 64 units last year to 98 this year, because that OPEX just drives down then. It's going to be this, you know, we're just going to lower cost per unit. So that's the first opportunity. The second opportunity beyond that is, and I'm going to expand a little bit, the opportunity and the reason we went public is there is an entire classic car community and ecosystem that we just scratched the surface of. There are no comps in this sector.
Okay.
Nobody's done it before. But if you start to join the pieces of the jigsaw together, it's about, we think, because we can't find a lot of research on it, but we've pieced it together, about $15 billion annually in the US.
Wow.
Classic car.
$15 billion. Okay.
So let me break those 5 points down for you. One is manufacturing, which is where we sit, and a ton of other mom and pops at that 2 to 5 million range sit. Then you've got people at the 10 million range, and then you've got the few at the top like us at the 25 to 40 million range revenue per year.
Okay.
So manufacturing is a big pot in itself in terms of roll-up opportunities and M&A. That's the first part of the ecosystem. The second part of the ecosystem beyond that, then, the biggest one is financial services. How do you insure these cars? How do you resell them? How do you raise finance to resell them? How do you lease them? How do you even rent them?
Oh, yeah. So
there's an entire financial services sector that we're doing indirectly because some of our clients do it that way, but we're not involved in.
Okay.
And we don't really deal with the guys that are offering that service. Beyond that, then you've got supply chain. Supply chain is one of the biggest opportunities because we're all buying from the same vendor base and none of us are really looking at margin efficiency by tooling and doing it ourselves.
Sure.
But there's a huge opportunity in the supply chain side of this, which is billions of dollars. Then the really big one is lifestyle. I challenge you to go to any city, any major city, secondary city, even small towns and cities, somewhere this weekend, nearly every city is having a cars and coffee social event.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So you take all of those people and throw them into one big pot, and how many millions are there in the US? You know, how many? I mean, I would imagine everybody in the US, a car is arguably part of their life.
Yes.
But then take a high percentage of that and say, well, it's not just a part of my life. It's a part of my social life and my lifestyle. So lifestyle is the third element of the ecosystem, which is car events, storage of cars, transportation of cars, concourse events, etc. And then after that, you've got market channels. So all the chance to market, auction houses, you know, Mecum and some of the big events, they're commanding. I mean, there's cars, classic cars, changing hands for millions of dollars.
Yes.
Every day in the auction houses.
Yes.
So if you put manufacturing, lifestyle, financial services, supply chain, and market channels, that's where the $15 billion ecosystem TAM comes into play, where you can literally say, well, if we all just stop being fragmented and started to play together in a consolidated way, somebody's got the opportunity of being on top of the food chain there. And I think LVMH did it brilliantly.
Yes.
I think LVMH, they just said, we're a luxury brand. And then they just went, okay, we're plugging in Tiffany. We're plugging in Moët & Chandon. We're plugging in Tag Heuer. You know, they just literally said, parent parasol luxury brand company, plug in all the elements. And the owner of a classic car at the price point we're at, what they actually want is a white glove, everything solved for them, solution-based service.
Absolutely.
If they want to build the car, one company, finance the car, one company, service the car, one company, store it, one company. What they have to do right now is go left, right, east, north, south. They're going everywhere, whereas nobody's putting an all-encompassing system. Now, I can't do all that on my own, but I'm very open to like-minded businesses in those fields I talked to and saying, well, why don't we just figure out how we do this together?
Yes, and in terms of the opportunity for you to expand the brand, and you know, some like Elon is very good at this at Tesla with ancillary products. Do you feel you have that opportunity, since obviously you didn't make the vehicle in the first place? Land Rover did, or Jaguar, or whoever. Can you capture that share of the wallet as ECD Automotive when your product is branded with somebody else?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, being candid with you, I mean, our base vehicle doesn't cost what I sell it for.
Of course.
The value is not in the Jaguar Land Rover brand, although the history is. The value is in what we do with that product. And the actual value is in, there's two parts to our product. And I think it's important I get that across when I said we disrupted the automotive industry. The first part, visibly and clearly, is the vehicle itself. At the end, you're going to get a beautiful one-on-one car. There's no question of that. But what we actually did is put you in a very immersive design experience where you were at the center of it.
Yes.
You just visualized the car of your dreams. And we said, well, we've got the craftsmanship, the skill set, the efficiencies, the process, the building, the supply chain to build it for you. That is transferable across multiple brands. Let's not get hung up on the fact that I'm a Brit and I build a British product. The scalability of this business is certainly not doing it that way. I'm not going to give the numbers out there, but the search volume for an American product on Google, a classic American product, is much greater than a British classic product. So when you talk about ancillary income streams, I think there's a whole roll-up plan and a whole migration of our efficiencies, because I'm not from automotive. The guy in the building today who you don't want to touch your car is me. I'm the least mechanical guy. I don't have any oil change. But I've surrounded myself with 100 automotive misfits that are very capable of doing that. So there's a deal in the business. I will never build a car and they won't run the business. The people that traditionally run these, the people that are running these businesses, and I've got such admiration and respect for them, that are doing 2, 3, 4, 5 million a year, they are mechanics. And they're getting phone calls saying, could you build me this car? Could you build me that car? And they just don't know how to scale, and they don't know how to deploy capital because they're great mechanics and they don't know how to do it the other way. Where ECD can help is taking those and helping them apply our kind of secret sauce of how we scaled, so that when the phone rings and you say, I've got a 3-year backlog, I can't take your deposit, actually we turn around and say, yes, we can take it because we're building one every 4 days. So right. I think the opportunity first and foremost is to get efficiency into a lot of those businesses, and we can help them in M&A and roll-up. But to your point, is there ancillary income streams? Absolutely there is, but mainly in the lifestyle sectors, I said. Yeah. All the elements of the car that the classic car owner wants to not deal with because they're very busy people, and if you can afford this price point, they're going to be. They just literally want to say, they're not cash starved, they are creatively starved and they are time starved.
Right. Yeah.
And my job is to ensure that we solve those issues for them so that owning a classic car is painless. And the ancillary income streams come exactly from that, mainly through the lifestyle element, I said, that, you know, there are people that want to spend their weekend or celebrate a 60th birthday in the environment looking at hundreds of these classic cars and paying a membership fee to be part of it and drinking nice whiskey and smoking a quality cigar while they're staring at classic cars. I mean, you know, that is exactly how myself and my founders met. you know, we were at a barbecue at my house, but we just sat in a corner and looked at cars all night.
Okay. And in terms of the sourcing process, you know, where are you getting these old Defenders, for instance, and how do you deal with the left-hand drive, right-hand drive issue?
Well, first and foremost, I don't deal with the left-hand driver issue because the consumer decides that. The client decides it.
Sure.
If the client says they want it left, we'll get it left. If the client says they want it right, we'll do it right. It's okay. A choice in the menu design. And many will do that. Some will say, just keep it original, as classic as you can. But we've got the systems here to convert it, absolutely, and 95% are converted, as you said. The base cars themselves, there are 2 million available. 2 million of the Defender were produced in its lifespan up until 2016. Every year they age out, and at 25 years old, we can import them into the US. So there is no shortage of demand. If I ever have the problem of building and restoring 2 million, that's a beautiful problem I'd like to handle. But I don't think we'll ever get to that problem. So supply chain is not a challenge for us. We, in COVID, identified very quickly, I think one of the benefits what we're very good at ECD compared to traditional automotive. We're very agile. We call it traction. We don't have committee meetings and board meetings and come out with new solutions. As COVID arrived, we said we're going to get hit on shipping fees. We're going to have supply chain challenges. So let's control it. So I split the management team, sent two back to the UK for a year, set up a UK logistics facility that allowed us to control sourcing of product, price of sourcing, quality of product, and shipping. Okay. Every container we sent was 101% full, I can guarantee you. Wow. We maximize our efficiencies. So sourcing is something we got under control very quickly. Nothing frustrates me more in 2024 when you go in a mainline manufacturer site and you go to design a car and a box comes up and it says, due to worldwide parts shortage, you can't choose that option. My daughter just bought a new car. I'm not going to mention the brand, but there's a $2,000 upcharge for a functioning that doesn't work because they haven't got the part to make it work, but you still give you delivery of the car.
Wow.
I can't comprehend that. Supply chain. Look, I mean, I'm going to be brutally honest. If we hadn't figured out supply chain, we wouldn't be here.
Right.
You know, because we weren't the power plants of the automotive world where we could just say, well, we'll produce that ourselves. So one of the founders, Elliot, the younger brother, he's the chief technical officer. Elliot runs all of the sourcing and procurement side of making sure we can build whatever we decide to put in production.
Okay. And in terms of the economics, without giving away too much of the what you call the secret sauce, I'm trying to figure out how much I guess I should be able to do it backwards because you've talked about a 30% gross margin, but how much does a 25-year-old Land Rover Defender cost? And can you just go through, this is all available on your website, but for everyone's benefit, can you just go through the pricing options that you have after you've obviously done the restoration and modification?
Yeah, I mean, the economics are fairly simple. To enter the price point, if you just took a base contract car, and I hate saying that because it certainly isn't a base contract when you get the car, it's about $250,000. If you just took the off-the-shelf, no upgrades, it's $250,000. Nobody has ever designed a car in ECD without adding upgrades. A history of the design process. So $250,000 is your base contract. But for that, you absolutely could take a really good, everyday running, reliable GM power plant, great quality of finish, Defender 110. Then what we do is we, from day one, deployed about 7% of revenue to client services.
Okay.
From day one, I said, if we're going to hold the client's hand, we've got to act like you would in the Ritz-Carlton, and you've got to put staff behind that. So there is a huge team of staff from our design team to our 3D design team to client services managers to warranty team. They are going to, via phone, not via email, if you ring our warranty department, a person will answer 24/7 and they will talk to you. So it's very heavily labor-based in that sense, but we always added that cost into the price of the car from even in the early days when we were charging like $125,000 for a car.
Okay.
So we've always added labor to service the luxury experience. But as you go through that luxury experience, we are bringing the client into the Disney world of car design. So our client is not cash starved. They are creatively starved and time starved. So as we pull them away from their busy lives where it's very stressful, every couple of weeks we're contacting you over probably a 6-month period. You can go as quick as you like. You could do it all in one day if you wanted to do it, but most people enjoy it.
Yes.
So we're pulling Fortune 500 CEOs away from their busy jobs and saying, hey, just come away for 20 minutes and make a decision on color, make a decision on leather, make a decision on the depth of the thread you want. Let's make a decision today about the tip of the fuel gauge. What color do you want that to be? And we take them through a process. And every decision they're making a choice to add value to the vehicle. And that comes with a price point to it.
Yeah.
So the margin is where we make our margin. You know, the majority of our margin is made in the upgrades. Because if I give you the economics of that, if you came to me today and said, you've got a Mercedes, let's do it as a Range Rover, it's easier. If you said you got Obsidian Black Range Rover, which is a stock color from Jaguar Land Rover, a Range Rover coming yes. that color, and Defender does. If you said you want that paint today, I'd say, okay, we'll do that for you. If your friend came and said, well, I want my Defender the color of my house in the Hamptons or something. Yeah.
Okay.
And they've sent me the paint sample, and they do that a lot. We had a lady send us a bag. We've had a lady send us a nightgown. They'll send you something. Yeah. So then we will say, okay, we'll color match that for you and we will do paint to sample. That paint to sample charge, as do Ferrari, as do Porsche, as do Ferrari, is about a $17,000 to $20,000 upgrade.
Okay.
My raw material cost is similar, whether you choose the Jaguar Land Rover paint or you choose the paint to sample color, because I'm mixing it in-house. I don't buy paint from Emily. We use PPG Deltron paint, which is exactly the same as Ferrari use. It's the highest quality automotive paint.
Okay.
But my guys in-house in our paint facility are mixing that color. So whether they're mixing a stock color from Land Rover or whether they're mixing a one-on-one color for a client, the color of his house or a nightgown or something, that's where the margin is coming from in the economics. But what I do want to reemphasize is exactly this. Nothing annoys me more when prices keep going up and value goes down.
Yes. Yeah.
You know, you're seeing it in the fast food sectors now, where I always had a saying, you never get good fast food. Well, now you don't get good fast food cheap.
Right.
Yeah. So we've been very conscious as we've put the price point of the car up that we've always added value. So something has evolved in the vehicle. So a vehicle that's getting built today compared to one that's getting built 10 years ago, you can put them side by side and it's a completely different product. So we're not that type of brand that just penny pinches and says, we're putting the pricing up, but we're not putting the experience or the value up. Absolutely, we'll put the experience up. And on the paint sample I'm giving you on that example, nobody else in the world can have that color.
Exactly.
We will not allow anybody to come and say, because we get that all the time. Somebody will look at a website and say, I want to buy exactly that car. And we'll say, you cannot buy exactly that car because that paint color, that design is the intellectual property is with the individual client. You can get it to look similar, but you cannot have the same. So where there is a paint to sample color, you can go to your friends, neighbors, family, and say, that's the only car in the world that's that color.
Wow, that's incredibly bespoke. Yeah.
So I think the economics are built through customization and commanding the price point for the quality of the product.
Okay. And if we could just segue, I was a car guy, sort of still am, but I was always a car stock guy.
A car stunt guy?
A car stock guy.
No, car stock guy. I thought you said stunt.
I mean, I have to say, before Elon, it was pretty boring in the car stock world. So they never went up. But in terms of your stock, ECD Automotive, I think it looks like the chart looks like a lot of companies that have de-SPAC'd. What's the feeling from your board of directors on, you know, how do we get this stock moving again, like our product does, and just, you know, the perception of the investing world, how do you change that?
I think you've just answered it yourself. What we've got to do is get rid of the perception of being something that's just de-SPAC'd.
Yeah.
And I've got lots of answers to that. I mean, first and foremost, we're not a traditional de-SPAC. You know, if you've got four founding owners who took 150 grand and turned it into 22 million revenue with any external debt, I think that's not typical of a SPAC. You know, we've acted poor for a decade. We're very good capital allocators. We're very good at ROI. Okay. We wouldn't be where we were in our own if we didn't. So first and foremost, I think we've got to educate people that I don't think we are a typical SPAC when you've got 83 million revenue lifetime before being a public company. Right. I get it. I get the SPAC baggage. You know, we knew that as we're going into it. So how do I change perception? I deliver. Simple as that.
Okay.
It's not complicated. I execute what we said we're going to do. We execute in our quarterly performance. We execute in our annual performance. We execute in our M&A strategy. We execute in our roll-up. I'm now no different to anybody else, apart from I'm 10 runs down the ladder to a company that didn't do this via SPAC. You know, a decade ago when we launched DCD, I told America slowly, but it started to build quickly. You know, we had one social media follower, then 10, then 100, then now we're at 500,000. Wow. I told them we were going to LS3 power a defender, and everybody laughed at us. And we used the laughter as fuel. Our competitor said, you're not going to do it. And then we said, we're going to electrify Defender. So then we were the first to electrify Defender. We're on a second generation of EV. If you Google electric Defender, we rank one ahead of Jaguar Land Rover. It's wow. Unbelievable. If I'd said to people a decade ago, which we did it in 2017, we're going to electrify Defender, everybody laughed at me.
Yeah.
I feel now that's where we're at, and that's fine. If there are no comps and nobody's kind of done this, I don't think people are laughing through maliciousness, or I don't even know if they're laughing, but they're laughing because they don't know is what I'm saying, and I've got to educate.
Yeah.
And how you educate investors is by return. And how we return is we deliver on what we say we're going to do. And, you know, can that be harder than when we did it as independents? There are days where I say no and there are days where I say yes. But, you know, automotive, manufacturing, customization on your own cash flow through COVID, that was hell on earth.
Yes. Yeah.
And I don't think we were ever as focused and as disciplined at any time than when we went through COVID. And I think we came out of the gate better prepared than anybody else. So here we are, you know, we've de-SPAC'd, we're on the markets, we're visible, we have a plan, and relating back to my sports analogy, we're at the start of the season, the Super Bowl's in a few months, and we've got to execute.
And what you bring up an interesting point there in terms of powertrain, what percentage of your customers are choosing the electric powertrain versus the base, which I think is a Chevy engine.
Yeah. Well, I've got an answer. I always said that. First and foremost, it's not actually my decision. The business model is about the consumer making the choice. The client's going to make the choice.
Of course.
I don't lean one way or another. If a client says to me they want to EV it, I haven't got an opinion on it. So what percentage, in answer to your question, last year it was about 20%, 1 in 5, and this year it's closer to somewhere between 12 and 15%.
Okay.
Why? Why would I say there's a slight decline year on year? I think automotive in general is saying what's happening with EV. I think Elon's got it to a T, but I don't think anybody else has really figured out in some of the other brands. I mean, there's inventory sitting there. The best deal I could be offered in January when I was looking at, sorry, December when I was looking at buying a new daily driver was one of the luxury brands, and it was an EV. The only real deal I could find in the market was an EV luxury car. Wow. Below MSRP. So that tells you, I think EV is actually maybe struggling in mainline automotive.
I would agree.
For us, I think, you know, we've had clients have actually kind of hit that wall of, well, the infrastructure isn't there. You know, the superstructure isn't there. It's great. Like, so we actually developed fast charging, second generation EV. Allows you to charge the vehicle up to 85% in about 40, 45 minutes.
Wow.
So we added fast charging. But if there aren't enough fast charging points, I can't help.
That's the problem. Yeah.
So I think the idea of living with an EV car is appealing. But I think if you then have to live with it, I think that may be quite different. But you know what? The beauty of ECD is if you don't like it, send it back and we'll swatch you out for a V8 GM engine.
Right.
It's not a choice you have to stick with, because the skill set we've got, you know, we can convert it back if you wish.
Okay. Yeah, that's it's always great to have that option. So I guess the other is your customer base primarily in the U.S. or how does that work? It seems like it's focused on an American customer, but obviously it's a British product. So where are you selling these days?
That's an interesting question because it's just shifted quite dramatically, actually. So
okay,
we don't act like a traditional luxury brand in terms of marketing. We have two core channels for our marketing because in the old days we had no budget for it. So we hijacked an event in Malibu for one of the bigger brands that had all the automotive press there. And we sent a tweet out saying a few British idiots were in the mountains with an LS3 powered Defender.
Okay.
And they all come up the hill and drove the car. And we've just had great press relationships because I think the story is a bit quirky, a bit different. What we do is quite unique and the press like that. So the press are very active in sharing the cars we build, the innovations we do, the growth of the factory, the growth of the brand, the story. So, you know, I'm very grateful for the relationships we've got with some of the automotive press and the luxury brands, and they do a good job of telling a story.
Yeah, yeah.
Google, we've just done a really good job of telling stories on Google. We're storytellers. We're automotive storytellers. We're not pompous about it. I want you to read it. If you can't afford the product, I want you to read it. If you're an aspiring car kid that just loves cars, I want you to read it for your client. And Google has just ticked a box of that for us and said, you guys just write really compelling stories. You're going to rank organically. So wow. Across somewhere like 59 keywords, we rank on average 3.8. The real keywords in the top 20, we rank one. So Google and so to answer to your question, sorry if I'm being a bit long-winded.
No.
Google is dictating who sees our product. The press are dictating who sees our product. So historically, it was in the US. But interestingly, there was a pivot last year where we're still very strong in the US. But then all of a sudden, Canada came on the radar.
Okay.
So we're doing a lot of Canadian trucks. Then the Caribbean islands came on the radar. You'd never believe it. You know, Turks and Caicos, Bahamas, you know, all we started to get inquiries.
Yeah.
So that started to happen. And then last year, and I still can't run the economics in this, Europe started to contact us. So a number of cars are going back to Britain.
Sure.
Cars have gone to Poland. And I'm kind of like scratching my head saying, so the base car was built in England.
Right.
It's then lived in England for 25 years. We put it in a ship and bring it across to America. We customize it. Now we're sending it back to England.
Yeah.
And my head's, I've got to be honest with you, Jim, my head's spinning a little bit with that. And I'm saying, But actually, I stop it spinning and saying, and I don't mean this with any arrogance, please don't take it this way. That's the power of the ECD brand. I don't think you're buying a Defender. I think you're buying an ECD Defender or an ECD Jaguar E-Type. And I don't see how that's no different to Shelby with the Mustang brand. It's no different to Brabus with the Mercedes brand.
Get your AMG, Alpina, those sorts of, yeah.
We've built a name and a brand for excellence in restoring Defenders, Range Rover Classics, and E-Types. And when you talk about ancillary income and you were talking about Tesla, I continually scratch my head with why wouldn't we take some of the more modern JLR products and ECD them?
Yes.
So, you know, you could take a 2024 Defender, and I'm pretty sure if we put ECD custom elements on that, again, added value and character and stunningness and, you know, added a dimension to the vehicle that didn't come off the line with. And it is a great product. My wife owns a new Defender, and that's sacrilege in my house, by the way. But but if I could get hold of that Defender and say, look, I'm going to give it to my guy. And they did, actually. My guys took my wife's new Defender and did some stuff to it. And now it's the coolest, looking 2024 Defender on the up where we live. But I think that's the point. I have such admiration for Shelby and what they did.
Yes.
And I think that's where we are. I think we're in the infancy of that, where we're creating a brand of trust where people are saying, I just want ECD to do that for me.
Yeah, I think that's a huge opportunity to really expand what you're doing now. And, I would say, I mean, it sounds like you have some pretty great mechanics working for you, but is there any limitation to brands or body styles, or, you know, if somebody brought you a Model Y, could you Could you modify that?
It's a good question again. It's kind of happening. We have had to open a division at ECD Automotive Design called Boutique.
Okay.
I don't really want to get into kind of mechanics and the financial side of it and everything, but I can just tell you why it happened. So we have 1 in 5 clients is a repeat customer.
Wow.
So yeah, it's 20%. So now when you've been going as long as we have in this game, we've got a client on his 6th build. So he's on build number 6.
Okay.
So and I think what people are saying, not everybody, but a certain element of our clients are saying they just want a garage of ECD toys. So whether it's an EV Defender, a 90 Defender, a 130, an E-Type. So they've got a collection of them. And what happens then is because they've built that trust and they've got such a good range, they will ring us and say, I've got a X, right? An X could be any car. It could be a classic car. It could be a European classic. It could be an American classic. It could be something more modern.
Yes.
And they say to us, I want you guys to do it. And I don't ever believe, I mean, I think if you're the type of CEO that takes a call or the sales team tell you they're taking a call and somebody wants to spend upwards of $500,000 with you, you've got to be an idiot of a CEO to say no.
Right. Yeah.
So my challenge is to say to my C-suite and my management team and mainly my techs, because they're the kings of the business, the techs, the kings of the business, to say, my job, if you said to me, what's my job? My job is to say, how do I continue to get the 5% of everybody that works at VCD? When they say they can't do any more, how do I make them believe they can do more by getting that 5% out of them? So that's when those moments come in, when somebody rings us and says, I want you to do a one-off. And my team go, well, we only do this and it'll upset manufacturing. I go, but you can do it. Let's just figure out how. And that's where Boutique came from, which is we can take a product, isolate it in a corner, put it with our unicorns, as we call them, our really highest end guys. I have to do no more after that. These guys are going to go in there and go, this is like heaven. This is like what we do at a weekend with my old 67, you know, my old Camaro, my old Mustang, my dad's truck. And they're going, and I'm getting paid for it. And I've got a supply chain to support it. And I've got a procurement team. And I've got a marketing team that are going to put it out to press for me. So all of a sudden, the hobbyist, automotive misfit, as I call them, is now actually getting into it and bringing new product to life for us. But what I don't have to do is analyze it with a team of manufacturing engineers and a team of brand managers and a team of C-suites and does this fit? Should we have a committee meeting on it? Put it in a corner, let the guys figure it out. And when the client's ready to take delivery, it'll be a higher price point than one of our typical bills because it should be because it's a true one of one. So yeah, we can really apply it to any model. And I think Boutique, while it will always be small in volume, should always be part of ECD's character. And potentially there's maybe a business within a business we set up where we do a higher volume of them so we can cope with one-on-one requests. Because I don't ever want to say no to a $500,000 request to build a vehicle.
Sure, yeah.
I wouldn't be doing my job as a CEO if I did.
And yeah, every CEO should be focused on the top line first. Mm-hmm. Always have. I've been saying that for 30 years. Every once in a while, they actually listen to me. But
well, I had my first business at 24 years old, and I realized very quickly that revenue solved everything almost.
Oh yes. Okay. Well, we are coming up on the hour mark here, and I know you're very busy. So, I guess I will throw it over to you for any kind of exit statement you want to make to potential investors who obviously are the listeners of my podcast. So whatever you want to say.
I kind of just say, you know, trust us on the journey. I mean, I can't ask you to look at analyst reports and data when we've got some information out there now and there'll be more to follow. You know, we know that for sure. But, you know, I get it. We're quirky. We're different, but I always think the stocks that are picked best and go in the highest multiples are probably the quirkiest.
Yeah.
You know, if we were a cookie cutter and we were just automotive, I think that'd be a bigger concern. I think we are automotive disruptors. I think Elon was an automotive disruptor.
Very much.
I think Ferrari is an automotive disruptor. I think Ferrari stock is performing incredibly well, but I think it's justified. You know, they've got a backlog, they've got a price point, and they've got customization. Well, guess what? I've got all three of those. ECD Automotive Design is exactly the same mechanics. I shouldn't say mechanics, long analogy, but the same economics as Ferrari. You know, their price point's high, their customization's high, and their backlog's high. I mean, we have a full order book for 2024. Every car is sold.
It's a good point. Yeah.
So I think, you know, it's the kind of give us a chance, look at us, see we're quirky, but we're not. I use the comment a lot, you know, a few British idiots had a beer one night. And I like that because it grounds us and it keeps us human.
Right, right.
I look back on the last 10 years and we weren't. We were pretty smart. We were incredible capital allocators. That's the first thing we did really well. We allocated capital exceptionally well. We measured ROI very well. But first and foremost, we always knew we were driving, trying to build perfection. But I knew we'd never get there. It was just a GPS system.
Right.
So I became our own biggest critics. Nobody had to tell us where we'd, you know, everybody's going to write about our cars, whether they like them or not. But we'd already critiqued it to death ourselves. And we now continue to do that as a public company. We continually beat ourselves up on what we need to get better at and improve. So all I ask is kind of join us in the education journey, help us educate and raise awareness, and, you know, just kind of and watch and see what happens, because I do truly believe that ecosystem, that $15 billion market exists out there. And at some point, whether it's me or somebody else, somebody's going to consolidate it.
Yes, yes.
And at the price the stock is currently, it's one of those opportunities that may not come around very often.
Oh, yeah. And that's, you know, I would remind everybody who's listening that it's ECD Automotive, and it's ECDA is the ticker symbol on the NASDAQ. And yeah, I mean, you have a fan and you have someone who at some point will come down there to Kissimmee and drive a Defender. I'm inviting myself, by the way. I just did.
Oh, you're welcome. Nothing I enjoy more than tours. I love touring the factory.
And so, yeah. Thank you very much for your time, Scott. You've been very generous. And, you know, best of luck to you in the future.
I appreciate it. Thank you for your time.
Great. Have a good one.
Thank you.